It's committee for file. What is the name?
2531.
I think first we need to have Lexi go through perhaps the A9 amendment.
Where is the A9? Oh, here
it is. Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, does everybody have copies of the A9? Okay.
I got new entertainment play tricks.
So we'll walk through the A9, and I will note things that are different from the A7 that was before the committee committees yesterday. On lines 1.3 to 1.10, we insert the definition of prima facie for the definitions in Chapter 10A. This is the same. Lines 1.12 to 1.17 are the first part of Section 1 from House File 1961, and this is the audit language where the board must do audits within available resources. Then it has the language there about the including the name of the employee. Lines 18 to 19 are the language we talked about replacing just cause. So we removed that later from the amendment where it applied only to that one section and moved it to a more general section. So here it says the board shall waive a fee or civil penalty imposed by the board for just cause shown. And Mr. Goldsmith has also sent around some language that accomplishes basically the same thing, but goes about it a different manner if the committee wants to talk about that.
Do you want to talk now or later about the difference between here or there?
Should I finish the walkthrough and then we can come back? Lines 1.20 to 1.21 include the rest of the language from House File 1961, Section 1. And the reason this is done like this is the section was already in the underlying bill, so I just added it all together there. Lines 1.22 to 1.35 are rulemaking, and this is the same language from the A7. Lines 1.36 to 4.24 are nearly the same as the A7, with the exception of that when the period on line 2.14 was inserted, and the phrase that warrants a formal investigation, which is the language Mr. Goldsmith suggested yesterday, is inserted three places on line 28 to 29, line 32, and line 33 to 34. I'm skipping over to page 4 of the amendment. You'll see that starting on line 4.25, the language from Section 3 of House File 1961 is inserted here.
Mm-hmm. Just tell me again what number you're on.
Oh, I'm sorry. Page 4, lines, starting on line 25. This inserts the language from Section 3 of House File 1961. That carries through down through line 5.9. Lines 5.10 to 5.14. This is the language about the civil action. It reinstates the probable cause standard and adds the cross-reference to the existing civil action statute. And lines 15 and 16 delete the rulemaking deadline. And I should note that lines 5.10 to 5.16 are the same as the A7 amendment.
Let's go back to
Madam Chair, you'd also asked about the language about the civil penalties, waiving the civil penalties and fees and the difference between what's in the A9 and the language Mr. Goldsmith sent out. I'm not sure who all received that language. Mr. Goldsmith would recommend that the language, I suppose he's here. He could probably come up and testify if you'd rather him explain it, or I'm happy to do it.
Mr. Bolton?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Gary Goldsmith, Executive Director of the Campaign Finance Board. Ms. Stengel was working much later hours than I last night, so she had the amendment all prepared before I got this language to her this morning, but I did distribute it to at least the chair and the leads on the Senate side. And the effect is the same. I was proposing to put the language in the section of the statute, still in 10A.02, but in the subdivision that deals with fees already, so that it is more prominent and stands out and can be accessed more easily. Secondly, I included more detail, and this is because the normal process would be that we simply get a written request for this waiver. The person doesn't have to come in and make a proof before the board under oath of good cause why the waiver should be granted. They send us a letter asking for the waiver and explain why. And since typically a waiver is going to be granted without a personal appearance, the request should be in writing, which I specify. It should at least be certified under 10A.025, which says the person says that it's true, and then the rest of it is the same. The board must waive. And instead of just making it apply blanket to all late filing fee and civil penalty, it would be to waive that portion of the late filing fee and civil penalty for which they've demonstrated good cause for being late. And that's because what routinely happens is somebody will not get their mail, or for some reason there's some confusion. So they have a reason for the first week or so, but after we've been in communication with them and they've had several more days and still don't file, and then it goes on weeks and weeks, while they may have had good cause to waive the first several days of a penalty, they don't have a reason going forward. So this would clarify that such an amount as they provided good cause for not filing would be waived, and if they didn't have good cause, some part of that penalty might still stay in place.
We put it in the place that he just described. Anybody have any discussion around that?
Madam Chair, we have an amendment to that effect that we can, so people can look at.
Thank you.
In favor of this A12 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Then there were a couple of two or three sections that I thought we had discussed before that when a definition has now been created in statute around probable cause, because it's the first there's prima facie, then there's probable cause and investigation. Having it said in that process, it now changes the meaning and feel of probable cause. So therefore, some of the places where probable cause was put back into the language ruins the meaning and intent. And I thought we discussed a few of those before, but we need to make sure that we don't have that happen. Let me see. So I think it's 5.10. Okay, that's 5.11 and 5.12. Refers to the bills, page 12, line 11. So on the original version, on the House side, that constitutes probable cause is crossed out, and where there is a reason to believe is in there. And the Senate is taking back that constitutes probable cause. But in so doing it now with the definition of probable cause differently, this particular section, as I understand it, is under the part of the statute where you're working on conciliation, through a conciliation process. It has nothing to do with the prima facie, probable cause, investigation. It's the easy way. It's the informal way. And so now to say that constitutes probable cause, you now stick it back into the other process when it doesn't belong in that process. So it's just a conciliation process, and then when the matter reaches a point where there's reason to believe that excess expenditures probable or contribution cause have been done, then you don't make a finding of probable cause because now probable cause is a different definition. You just make a public finding in the matter, and you're done with the informal process. So to put the words probable cause in here is a misstatement. Is that, do you want more explanation from someone else on that?
Well, Madam Chair, it feels to me like where we put in language where there is reason to believe rather than constituting probable cause, it's just a lesser standard. If this is something that the chair feels is important, I will accede to the will of the chair on this issue.
Okay, I think that if I had had time to look up section 10A.28, subdivision 4, I could have looked around that section and realized it was a totally different process than the formal process that you're looking at really defining and holding to. This is a different process, and it gets confused when you throw the probable cause element into that. I think that you'll be comfortable with this.
I what I'm saying, Madam Chair, is I'm not sure that I agree with you, but I'm willing to go along.
Okay, then we won't discuss it anymore. All in favor of, for lines on the amendment A9, lines 511 and 512, delete those, and then it would be revert to the house. The intent is to revert to the house language on house section 15.
Madam Chair, lines 13 and 14 also amend that same section.
And I understand that's not a problem to keep that in there. So the first part of House Section 15. All in favor of that change, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries. Okay. And then what's this one? Just looking at the side by side on sections, the Senate Section 7.
Reverting to the house.
This is the one we discussed last time, and I thought we had an agreement on it that we would revert to the house language of the House Section 5 because it, now that
conciliation.
When you put prima facie in there, you then have the documentation from the prima facie violation as confidential, but you have removed the confidentiality from the record of the investigation. You want to keep the house language that says the record of the investigation, now that at the end would be retained for no more than a year or destroyed or given back or whatever. So that's important level of, that's where all the documentation is at that level of the investigation. To change it to just the prima facie violation is to just take a little bit.
And Carolyn, Representative, just for, we're on R7, right?
R7, Section 7, compared to Section 5 in the House.
Okay. So our Section 7 and Section 5 of the House.
It's side by side.
621. Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I might clarify, Madam Chair and members, to recall last night's conversation, this is the provision that tells the board at what point it should decide whether information that would harm an innocent person should be remained. Should be given back to the person or remain confidential for a year, and that should be at the end of the investigation, and that's what the house language would do. This doesn't have anything to do with actually releasing the investigative file itself. It just relates to evaluating particular information that could damage an innocent person.
So, Madam Chair, are you still suggesting we accept the, we do the house language on that?
We revert to the house language, yes.
Okay. So it's nothing to do with, it's, this is about the retention for 1 year, it must be destroyed or return the statement document in matter.
All the documentation from the major investigation.
I'm okay.
Madam Chair, what happens to the data regarding the allegation of prima facie violation?
Is there an answer?
Madam Chair,
with
due respect to make a correction, this doesn't relate to all the documentation of the investigation. It says, if the board concludes that the record contains a statement or document that, if disclosed, would unfairly injure the reputation of an innocent person. So it's a very narrow category of document we're looking at this point. That document would then remain confidential for a year and be destroyed and given back to the person. The rest of the investigation would be released as it is now at the end of the investigation. That would include the probable cause finding and other components. This is a very unique, and as I mentioned last night, has only been used once in the 17 years that I've been with the board.
Okay.
That's fine. I agree. No,
sure. Okay, and we'll revert to, or we'll take the House language on Section 5 of the side-by-side. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
And opposed nay. Okay, motion passes. And then Senator Hoffman and I talked about how in the 1961 bill, you had taken the first section having to do with audits, and we had suggested that if you wanted to, that along with that goes the last section, Section 4, that has to do with confidentiality on the information that goes with that. And you thought that would be fine to add that piece.
Investigation and report. So subdivision 10, section 4, and section 1, subdivision 10.
What you do?
All right.
Why don't you pass out the draft? I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Okay.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Could we have our Lexi explain this?
Yes.
A 10.
Lexi.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The A-10 amendment takes parts of House File 1961. It takes what is paragraph B of Section 4 in 1961. Paragraph B talks about how the audit data is confidential data. The amendment does not include paragraph A, which had the requirement to disclose underlying data. And this amendment also takes Section 5 from House File 1961 without any changes.
Okay, and the bottom part of this amendment, let's see. All right, I'm wondering about the Section A of this subdivision. That's a problem.
No, I don't think that is a problem. Senator Newman, because that's just subdivision 5. That's just cleaned up language.
Didn't we agree to this last night, Madam Chair, didn't we?
You hadn't identified which parts of the 1961 that you would.
I thought it was the two. It was the first one, which is subdivision 10, section 1, subdivision 10, and subdivision 10 for section 5. Section 4, subdivision. That's the same? Oh, okay. Right. Okay.
Madam Chair, the Section 20 that is on line 16, where is that coming from? I'm getting my bills shuffled.
Madam Chair, let me see if I can add some clarity. So looking at the A-10 amendment, lines 1.4... to 1.14 of the amendment are the same as paragraph B of Section 4 of 1961. So looking at 1961, there are two paragraphs. Paragraph A has the requirement to disclose underlying data, and paragraph B classifies the data as confidential. This amendment only takes paragraph B. Lines 1.15 to 1.20 of the A-10 amendment are identical to Section 5 in House File 1961, and that's simply a cross-reference in the Data Practices Act to the section above, so everybody knows that that data is confidential.
And I was asking about paragraph A under Subdivision 10 in 1961.
The part that's not included.
Yes.
So are we doing any more of 1961?
We're trying to see if they will take the whole section four of 1961.
I'm lost.
Paragraph A?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Just look at 1961, section
four.
Oh. That's what this amendment is that we have in front of us, the A10, correct?
It leaves off the first lines.
Yeah, it just goes to the data related to the audit. It's classified as confidential data.
Yeah, I'm
okay. Section B, here, Senator Nunez.
I'm addressing section the A. I'm addressing the first part of that section.
Subdivision 10?
Yes. Subdivision 10, part A.
You're asking, Madam Chair, if you want it, if we'll agree to keeping that Section A language in. Is that what you're asking?
If I may, Madam Chair, I will agree to paragraph B of Section 10. I will not agree to Section A.
I think just B is going to be okay. Because we're already, the audit, you're talking, Madam Chair, the audit and investigations under Section 1, Subdivision 10, right? This would just be an addition. I'm okay with B. I think that's just rolls into what Section 1 is doing. All data related to it. Yeah, because it gets to the confidential side of it. So I'm okay with B. Are you okay leaving A out? I'm okay with leaving A out, Madam Chair.
I would prefer A in because it allows them to actually check the data to see if it's an accurate statement. And then the confidentiality relates to that information. So,
Madam Chair, don't we just see board must make sound investigation with respect to the credits of the chapter final audit. Section B then says, in conducting the audit of data report of the board may require an entity to disclose the underlying data which the statement
on which the statement is based.
On which the statement is based. So it's going to be, show me the data. Okay, with this is going.
No, I won't agree.
Okay,
and I discussed this issue yesterday, okay. So I'm not going to bother to repeat myself, except that I will not agree.
You won't agree on A.
I'll agree to B. I will not agree to A.
All right.
That's as succinct and clear as I can possibly be.
So you don't think nothing? You don't think anything's lost? Then Senator Newman, on if A is not in there,
Senator Hoffman, I will not agree to requiring people to disclose to the board their underlying data. I will not agree to.
Okay. So your issue is I understand your issue. I don't know. I don't understand the question. Does it change if it's requested? I don't understand your question.
If they can request it as opposed to require it, most people.
There is the word may in there. May.
So it's permissive language anyway. Would that be all right?
No.
You don't even want it in there.
It will not. And again, I discussed it yesterday.
Yeah, I remember now.
And honestly, I thought we were going to put together an amendment that was drafted, and now we're redrafting the amendment again. And I'm trying to be reasonable and agree to accepting the changes in the A9 amendment. Now we're beginning to change the A9 amendment. So. The answer, Senator Hoffman.
Okay, I hear you.
Is that if paragraph A goes in, I vote against the bill.
All right, I don't need that. Let's can we keep A out?
All right, let's hold off on A10 for a minute and see what else we have on the table here. We had the changing A9 amendment. Something that you had told me.
Yesterday we talked about, Madam Chair, we did, and with the addition of Senator Newman's language on the bottom, which Senator Newman, can you, if the information is given, how did you?
Get into, Madam Chair, if I can get into the right, this is what we're talking about.
Yep, that is right. So you're okay if expedited includes one point of the A9 amendment, the 1.28 on, correct?
That is correct. And effectively, the way I look at that is the language on page one of the A9 amendment, beginning at line 0.28. That is in effect our sonar. And so if we have that language in, then I will agree to the expedited rulemaking process.
So if sonar means the not expedited, right?
Correct, yeah.
So then
he was all day this morning. He was sonar guy.
If this is making it sonar, how is it made expedited? I guess I'm
maybe. Madam Chair, I'm sorry I didn't explain myself clearly. I am looking at that language of beginning at line 28 that I would treat it as a sonar because it provides me with information. And again, in an effort to accommodate the committee and put the expedited in that is being requested, if I receive the requested language beginning at line 28, I'll accept the expedited rulemaking.
Which is the House language, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Right.
So I would leave it to staff to draft that properly since I don't know what you
say. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. To reinstate the expedited rulemaking, we would delete lines 1.22, 1.23, and 1.24 of the A9 amendment.
That's expedited.
And that will put the bill back to how it was with the expedited rulemaking.
Our original bill. It goes back to the original bill, Madam Chair.
Yep.
Except we're at a minimum, which I don't know.
Which lines, 1.22 and what?
22, 23, and 24. Line 25, is that what the question is?
Yes.
Line 1.25 deletes the phrase at a minimum, which means that the authorization to make rules is only for those five things listed instead of opening it up to anything beyond that. So the at a minimum doesn't relate to the expedited rulemaking.
At a minimum contains it. At a minimum.
So
deleting at a minimum keeps it to five.
Yes.
So.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If Senator Newman would yield for a question, because I want to make sure that I understand what the bill is going to say when it's written. In the notices that we're going to be giving to the chairs and leads of the committees, it does say, after taking any of the following actions, and one of the actions is the sonar, but under expedited rulemaking, there is no sonar. So I assume this isn't intended to require us to do a sonar, since expedited rulemaking would not require a sonar. I just want to make sure that's the intent. Or that the line 1.34 could be deleted since expedited rulemaking would not involve a sonar.
So that's kind of Greek to me. Could you answer that?
Madam Chair, Mr. Goldsmith's understanding is correct.
Okay. And so do we need the 1.34? Is that what was just said?
I think we would not need line 1.34 then, but I'd prefer to close.
Oh, yeah. That's the sonar. That's the issue of statement of need.
Because it's limited to five things, is specific?
No, I would disagree with Mr. Goldsmith on that issue, and that's one of the things that we discussed ad nauseum on the floor of the Senate today, where there's an attempt to get rid of the sonars and attempt to put in a more general description of a statement of need and reasonableness, and that's what we're specifically talking about here. So it's not an official sonar, and a sonar is defined by statute. This is a more general description, but I certainly think that the board should be responsible in an expedited proceedings to provide a statement as to why it is needed and why is it reasonable, but not a statutorily defined sonar.
Okay. And I'm going to agree with you, and then I'm just going to wonder if the rules that you're asking them to do are the rules that you you want, do they have to make a statement as to why they're needed and reasonable? And they're needed and reasonable because you told them to do them. My flippant way of saying it is this not true?
That is not how I would look at it. We are telling them what rules that they are to implement, and if they feel that they need more direction, then they should tell us. The statement of need and reasonableness goes to what are they proposing to enact by way of rules, not the enabling legislation where we direct them to make the rules. I want to see what it is that they're proposing to do.
All right.
And I think that's a different issue.
Okay. All right.
That works.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I don't think there was ever a motion made to delete lines 22, 23, and 24.
All right. I make the motion to delete line in the A9 amendment, line point 22, point 23, and point 24. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries. We have one more thing before I get into the four things that are left on the table.
That's it.
I'm going to ask Mr. Goldsmith if there was something on the A9 from 4.8 to 4.15 that needed the House language, because I am forgetting.
Yes, Madam Chair and members. The A9 reverts to the original language that's currently in statute. And if you look at page R7 of the side-by-side, on the House side, you'll see the board's recommendations, which were actually technical recommendations, not substantive. Remember that these recommendations were made before the Senate developed its concept of a probable cause hearing, which is now going to be defined in statute with notice requirements and time frame and so on. The original board recommendations resulted from the fact that last year the legislature changed what we do at the end of an investigation. At the end of an investigation, we used to make findings concerning probable cause. Now we make findings of fact and conclusions of law and issue an order. But now we also are going to have defined in statute something that is in fact a finding concerning probable cause, and it has its own time frame and its own requirements. The problem with reverting back to the original current statutory language is that we're using old words, probable cause, to set time frames, and those old words now reflect a new concept with its own time frame. So to be more specific, on paragraph C, which is at the top of page R7 on the House side, if you read the language as it exists now, this talks about when the board has to give notice of an investigation. Talks about the board making a finding. And if you don't take the House amendment, it will say the board must not make a finding of whether probable cause exists to believe without giving notice. That whole concept is now embodied in new language. There's a definition of probable cause, a requirement for notice in writing to the person, a requirement that they be allowed to appear before the board, and then the board has a hearing. The House language would, by changing this to say the board must not make a finding that a violation has occurred without notifying the individual, relates to the finding once an investigation starts. So by using the House language, a second notice would be required once an investigation is actually undertaken. The probable cause notice is already in the Senate language. So the House language actually provides more protection and more notice to persons who are affected by complaints than leaving the old original statutory language. And then paragraph D refers to when board members and the public can talk about a complaint. complaint and when the record becomes public and what becomes public. And under the original language, which if you want to look at the original language without markup, it's on the A9 headline 4.13. The current language says a hearing or action before the board other than a finding concerning probable cause or conciliation agreement is confidential. That made sense when the finding of concerning probable cause was the final document in an investigation, but now that's an interim step, and so we would not want to have the investigation become public, the whole investigation become public at that interim step. The investigation should become public once findings, conclusions, and orders have been issued, which is the final step. So these were technical amendments that were beneficial but not absolutely necessary previously, but now that we have defined probable cause in its hearing and have different dates for it, it's important to change this so that these things occur at the end of the investigation.
No, fine.
This is their language.
No, this is the Senate. This is the
I understand that.
Yep.
That was their
original.
There was their original.
Yeah.
I'm okay with it.
You're okay with that?
Madam Chair, we're okay with the House version.
Do you have that clear? Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Is it both paragraph C and D of the House language?
In A9, C and D, yes. House language, C and D, yes.
Okay, so
this isn't our request, is there?
Yeah. On the A9 amendment, yeah. We would delete lines 4.8 to 4.21. And in it, does it go to paragraph E isn't changed. So we can leave paragraph E. Paragraph E isn't changed in the House, the Senate, or the amendment. So we delete lines 4.8 to 4.21 of the A9 amendment. And from the side-by-side page R7, insert House lines 5.8 to 5.16.
Okay, very good. I make that motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed nay. The motion passes. Okay. And with that, I think that we can look at the last four things that have not been talked about at all yet. The Senate has three items and the House has one. The Senate has the executive director is not ex officio. It has some given statute about some of the board operation, and it has a website for data storage. The House has travel is allowed out of the in your campaign usage, right? So I will make a suggestion for the board agenda piece because I find it basically difficult that Michigan in statute how a board operates. I've never been on a board that had statutory requirements for how they do their agendas. That in fact, they determine that by their bylaws and their actions. And so putting that in statute is very strange to me. And the most strange part is when you have an agenda as a board, to say, do you want to change, take something off the agenda or add something to it is simply the first item on the agenda. Do you consent to the agenda? Does anybody have any additions or subtractions? Period. It's the first item you take up. And now you're saying that that would be in statute that they'd have to have unanimous consent take up something else. So it's very strange to me. And I would certainly not be able to put into statute that they'd have to have unanimous consent to make a change in the agenda. So
you're suggesting, Madam Chair, no, that's fine. You know, it should be the majority. I think that you're right. As both former school board members on consent agendas there. My whole point was getting information and packets to the board ahead of time in that 7-day rule. But I would be more than happy to accept your, I think you had mentioned just the majority, right, of the.
You'd take normal operations.
Normal operations, the majority. If there's five people there, it's the majority of five people that right. can yeah, don't withhold. Yeah, I'm fine with that.
So I don't know where that is in
Chair, that section is on page R4, Senate Section 4. I think the lines are dying by 3.1 and 3.13.
Yeah, we're not taking off the 7-day notice. What we're saying is we're getting the unanimous consent because Representative Lane raised a perfect point in saying if you wanted to bring something up outside of that, you know, a board member wanted to bring something up, it just could be the majority of the board can come up with that. Yeah, I'm okay with that.
And you got deep concerns about having it in statute that they must have. When it's going to be recommended, when stuff is going to be brought to the board or distributed to the members 7 days in advance, you want that in statute?
I do want that in statute.
Absolutely.
All right.
I hate surprises. All my years on a board, I handed the one day, here's a packet, and I'll make a decision based on this packet. So I want that in statute.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, I agree with that with the change to not a unanimous, but majority.
I think it's doable.
So that we'll take very the good. Senate language on that with the change to majority consent instead of unanimous. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed nay. Motion passes. And then House member.
Issues? Are there any other issues? Because I think she thinks it's narrowed down to four. That's one of the four.
And then she's got, what was the other one that
she had?
She's talking about the travel.
Oh, that one you guys had that.
Whatever she decides on that.
Oh, yeah.
All right, we
travel.
Have.
So I can't take my three trips to Barbados this winter on behalf of
the House has a provision that limits travel out of the country to one paid for by campaign finances. And I would prefer to have that taken out. So.
Oh, your house, you want the House version taken out?
I want the House version.
We just fought over that, and she
did.
Won.
Did she won?
Could you direct me to so I could read it quick?
Yes, where is that?
It's House Section 3. It's on, starts on page R1.
R1.
Madam Chair, just to be clear what the policy is, so this is the definition of non-campaign disbursement, so it doesn't prohibit a candidate from traveling more than once. What it does is say that if you're going to claim expenses related to a trip as a non-campaign disbursement, you can only claim it for one trip, and any other trips would have to be paid for through campaign expenses and not as a non-campaign disbursement. And that affects whether the cost is affects the spending limit.
So,
talking about the hill in Silver Lake.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Madam Chair.
If we're comfortable with this, we can go ahead and vote for it to remove the Senate section, the House section three.
Madam Chair, we just don't do anything with it.
We don't do anything with it.
If we don't vote to adopt it, it's not in.
Okay, we don't vote to adopt it.
We'll withdraw your motion.
Right, very good. The e-motion. And then there's the website for data storage that is in the Senate but not the House. I suppose that's the same thing. If we don't do anything, it just disappears. I would be willing to accept the Senate's version of the campaign finance board looking at beginning the process of creating data storage potential, which, as my understanding is, would be voluntary for campaigns to use for ease.
Whole purpose of this. Voluntary.
Yes, yes. I'll just clarify with Mr. Goldsmith. As you look down the site, down the years for developing this data storage for campaigns to use, would it have a voluntary element to it?
Yes, Madam Chair. While electronic filing is, while filing in a format that the board can receive electronically is mandatory, there are several ways to do that. In fact, the state party units and caucuses use commercial vendor software. Most candidates use our existing software. For small committees, we'll be developing a website that doesn't store data. This would be an alternative to our existing software. At some point, we probably would come to you and ask to phase out the existing software, but this will be voluntary, and by the time we're ready to make it mandatory, it probably won't need a legislative act because everybody will be using it.
Okay, but there's always that next few years to look at it again if people had concerns. Okay, how do we do this? We accept the Senate's language on this.
Madam Chair, Section 19 goes along with Section 8, and that just puts a provision in the Data Practices Act that says the same things about data privacy as Section 8, so they're companions. So the motion would be to accept Senate Section 8 and Senate Section 19.
All right. Comfortable? Okay. Make a motion to accept the Senate's version of Section 8 and Section 19. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed nay. Motion carries. And I think the last thing left, if I'm correct, is ex officio. Is this not right?
There's a couple. You have to go back.
And Madam Chair, House Section 7 and Senate Section 10 are now identical. In the A7, there were some changes that were made, but in the A9, takes that away, so we could adopt House Section 7 or Senate Section 10 since they're identical.
I thought we did that. We're identical. They're identical now?
They're identical now under the A9. They were not under the A7.
Okay. All right. Then say it again.
House Section 7.
Okay.
Move to adopt House Section 7.
We adopt House Section 7. Yes. All those in favor say aye.
Get me into the
mode of it, right? I'm trusting her right now.
It's on top of page 5 of the side-by-side summary. It's the reconciliation information. That was the section where we were going to add just cause under the A7 amendment, but we've since moved that language to a different section, so they're now identical.
Okay. Oh, okay. Right. We're good. I'm sorry.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed nay. Motion carries. So
Senate Section 3. Whether the executive director is an ex officio member.
And A9.
Yes.
Up to A9.
Okay. Yep. So the A9 as amended.
And we have the A10 that amends the A9, and that's the other sections of 1961. And that was set aside earlier.
Okay. So as I'm looking at the A10, with that one piece, I am wondering about 1961 and the piece that has to do with simply now if we have something that comes on the House floor that will significant financial interest for us, we simply go to our leadership and say, I shouldn't vote on this, and they say, you're excused for voting on this, period. And we just want to add, if your spouse has a significant financial gain from what you're going to act on, you should go to your leadership and say, I shouldn't vote on this, and they say, you're excused for voting on this. Is there a problem with adding that? We almost never do the first. We almost never do adding the spouse, but it certainly tells the public we are clean on conflicts of interest.
Because it's not.
I'd oppose that. If a member believes that they have a conflict of interest by reason of something that their spouse is involved in, then it's up to the member to take care of it and be excused for voting. So, no, I would not agree with that statute.
So you agree with the intent and the idea, but we can't tell the public that we do it.
You can tell the public, Madam Chair, if you'd like to, but I think it's a personal responsibility of the elected officials. And we are confronted with conflicts of interest all the time. And, if you really get down to it, if an elected official violates a conflict of interest, I think it really has a lot more to do with the voters than the Campaign Finance Disclosure Board, to be real honest. So it may be an election issue. But I am going to resist dragging spouses into what an elected official has chosen to do, i.e. run for election. And I simply don't see the wisdom of doing that. Now, as I said, a member may have a conflict by reason of the fact that a spouse has an investment or whatever, but we easily could have conflicts for other reasons. And so I would just say if a member believes that they have a conflict of interest, they should go to leadership, get excused from voting, and that would be the end of it. And if the voters disagree, then that's up to them.
I'll just throw out that some states have spouse, children, anybody close to them is in this conflict of interest cause. But I suppose if the financial interest of the spouse is also your financial interest, it's going to be included in your own conflict of interest.
In your own conflict of interest.
If they're sharing resources and they're going to have a major gain, you're going to have a major gain. So some of that would be covered by that. I just think it's a small piece of clarity. And it just tells the member, be aware of this.
Yeah, I agree with that, Senator Newman. And you and I didn't talk about that earlier, but it starts to get, for me, that we're going to disclose that if it is a joint interest. You know, they're filling out some pretty deep information, but and you make the identification that some states, you know, have their kids disclosed. It's like, so if I happen to be a parent who buys into TEFRA, and then that means I can't vote on any Health and Human Services bills pertaining to medical assistance.
How this works. It's going to be a specific substantial financial gain.
I want to go with Senator Newman on this and just try to get this. We're almost close. We're close.
I'm just going to say that when you and I discussed, we kind of had the entire Section 14 or 1961, and now you're leaving off Part A. And I'm looking for something to satisfy me for losing that Part A in that A-10.
Madam Chair, you have, I believe, correctly outlined that if spouses have financial interests in investments and the elected official stands to gain by reason of those financial interests, then that that elected official is going to be responsible for disclosing it. I've got to say this. Our spouses are separate human beings, separate and apart from us. And oftentimes, they don't really even like the fact that we're running for office. They don't want anything to do with it. Our children most certainly have nothing to do with whether or not we run for elected office. At least my children don't. I simply believe that by reason of the fact that we are married to someone does not necessarily drag them into the life that we have decided to expose to the public. And I feel quite strongly about that. My spouse is a person in her own right. And if I have a conflict of interest by reason of something that she owns or she is doing, then I think I am obligated to come forward and disclose it. But to place it in statute, I'm simply not going to agree to it, Madam Chair.
I would just make the comment that it's sort of like doing a favor for your friend that would have a substantial financial interest. I'll vote on this because I know my spouse will win big. It's getting a little too close for comfort for, I think, the public to think that you would make a decision knowing that your spouse would win a financially large amount from that action. And for comfort, then you would simply remind members that they need to recuse themselves, even if your finances are separated, so it wouldn't be your financial gain. But somebody that close to you, the public needs to know that you're not making your decisions based on doing good things for a huge financial gain for that somebody that close to you. It's a simple thing in the world that we are in. It doesn't really have anything to do with the spouse being a unique person. It has to do with how close you are to this person and whether you make a decision that benefits somebody substantially, significantly, financially. So I'm just saying that Senator Hoffman indicated all of Section 14 on this, so if you don't want to go with Part A, then I'd like to have the spouse as the conflict of interest.
So can I caucus sure. with him for a second?
So
Representative Lane,
yes.
I, you know, we need to. I hear Senator Newman's concerns regarding the spouse, it's become a section where I think we're not going to agree on. So I don't know what our options are there. I don't want to see this bill die because we're almost there. We're close to being there, and I mean, how can we move beyond that piece of the.
Senator Newman has two objections, and I'm suggesting that the spouse one is very minor in comparison to his concerns about underlying data, or maybe perhaps the underlying data is less important since it will be source of investigation anyway. So it seems like one of these ought to be contained in our processes here.
Madam Chair, if I may, I would move the A-10 amendment.
Okay.
Move the A-10 amendment without section, without paragraph A. I will vote against that at this point. So do you want to take that vote anyway?
I do.
Okay. All in favor of the A-10 amendment as it stands right now, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Nay. Does not pass.
So it does pass.
So it does not pass.
Needs a majority on both sides.
Two and two.
So the A-10 is dead.
At this point, it has not been moved. I mean, it has not passed.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would move the A-9 amendment.
As amended.
As amended.
Without the A-10.
Well, this has the expedited rulemaking.
Yeah. Correct. We got all the agreements up to, except for the A-10, which is where we're at. So all the agreements we've had so far in the A-9.
My caucus will have some problems with the expedited rulemaking. I know that. Just on the record with that.
All in favor of the A-9 as it's amended, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say nay. Motion carries.
And Representative Lane, that's why we had added in there the sections that we thought would be help explain what we're doing there. So I appreciate your willingness to support that.
Well.
You can ask Matt to explain.
Mr. Gary has a comment about having adopted the A-9 without the A-10.
Madam Chair and for members, just to clarify, without this data classification language, I think a good deal of the data related to a board audit of an economic interest statement would remain public. So if you proceeded without the A-10 amendment or any version of the A-10 amendment, I think you'd be looking at quite a bit of disclosed public data related to an economic interest audit. Just so you know that as you discuss.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair. So, if I understand. Matt, right. This would do completely against what we originally wanted to do regarding data privacy. And so it saddens me that we're stuck over spouse, on the word spouse.
As I understand it, we would have the A-10 to discuss, spouse to discuss, and the ex officio. I believe that's everything left. And if you wanted to recess and think about it, that would be fine.
Well, I mean, we're not gonna bring the spouse language up. I mean, it's too bad that piece of it's
just a sticking point. If there's another option for us in there, I'd be more than happy to talk about that. But it's one little thing that is gonna kill the bill. So
paragraph A on section 14 on the A-10.
It's not permissive enough,
Madam Chair.
Yeah, you could bring in Winkler's gift. We go reverting to the original language on the gift ban. I mean, there's other options.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Goldsmith.
If I might comment in hopes of saving this bill, which has a lot of things that the board wants. The A-10 is an important amendment, and I agree that we would want this protection if we do audits. I think it's for the Senate's, it's consistent with what the Senate wants, but likewise, I think having the ability to ask for this underlying data, even though I believe we have it under other provisions of statute, to make it clear, I think that's important as well.
Okay, so we're left with clarifying that we have access to the underlying data, adding a spouse for conflict of interest, which, again, like I say, is a small step, or bringing in something like the reverting back to the original form of the gift ban. There's some options.
What language would be okay in here?
This language?
Yeah, what would be okay for you?
That's just on the audit.
That's the side of the audit.
May require the audit. You're not just going to this.
Yeah, this goes into here. So what I'm saying.
Because it's underlined.
So we disclose the data on which this, and this is the section here that we agreed to this.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So help me come with some better language there so it makes sense.
This is already.
So this is really not needed. This is already. Yeah, this is the body
is
of it.
Okay. This is it. This is the. This is something. I don't know what to go.
Well, the board. In my understanding, the board can ask for this. Correct. And this is. That's where it says this too, May.
I don't know who that would be.
Yeah, I want to recess for a couple minutes.
Recess, actually, recess or take a break?
Let's recess for 5 minutes. Take a break for 5 minutes.
All right, we're in recess.
Thank you.
Call the meeting back to order.
Okay.
So, Senator Hoffman, did you have anything to suggest?
I did, and you and I spoke, and unfortunately, you won't accept the word voluntarily, and I know it's not going to work, and the spouse language is not going to work. So unless we can really come to an impasse and move beyond that, we're not going to pass this bill as it stands.
Okay. I can't accept voluntary and reduce with the board. They already have the right to go at some data, and to say that it would be voluntary would be reduce their powers. I can't do that.
It's unfortunate that here we are trying to get some good work done, and we can't because of the spouse language, a bill that was brought to this, and the word voluntarily. And so it saddens me that we can't move. And we worked hard to get 99.9% of this bill completed.
Okay. That's true.
Unless we can come up with another word other than voluntarily, but you won't accept that. So.
So
I don't know what else to do.
Voluntary won't work, but there is the Part A of Section 4 on the 1961. There is the possibility of conflict of interest on spouse, and there is the whether we use ex officio language in the statute. Those are the things that are out there, and we can adjourn our request. I know I was agreed to that, but I couldn't go to agree to voluntary.
I guess we're done.
Okay. Do you want to recess or adjourn?
No, we'll adjourn.
Okay.
Thank you.
Your timing is impeccable.